TFM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I summoned you a while back. It sure took you a long time to get here.
Well, I don't understand, Chris, why I'm sitting in this room where broken filing cabinets and security cameras that don't even work. I'd really like to know what's going on and why you're sitting in this room.
Well, I'm just here to watch Agent Wells, Matthew, because he's got some questions for you, and he's going to share a little childhood encounter with us today.
Well, I'm excited to get to that, especially since, I feel like his childhood encounter has so much to do with the rest of the things that are going on this season.
Indeed they do. So we will discuss that shortly. Before we do that, here is a quick rundown of Star Trek Picard Season 2, Episode 8, Mercy. The story from Monsters picks up with Picard and Guinan being interrogated by an FBI agent who, it turns out, had a childhood encounter with Vulcans. Meanwhile, Queen Agnes rampages her way through Los Angeles eating batteries, and Corey soon learns the true nature of her existence. Rios serves cake aboard La Serena, and Guinan meets Q a century before their paths were meant to cross, and finds out that he is dying. But as he slowly disappears into nothingness, he reveals what may be the solution to the puzzle. So, Matthew, as we've been speculating pretty much the whole season, Q is, in fact, dying. That's what we thought. His situation is intertwined with Picard's, but we learned some interesting things in this episode about what's happening, why they're in the past, human nature, and Picard isn't the only one who needs to let go of something that's happened to him in his own past.
I did think that this was phenomenal, this idea of misunderstanding the past that obviously very much connects with what Picard himself went through, and that you then blame the wrong monster in the dark.
Right.
And I thought that that was a fantastic connection between these two people. And I think the other thing about it is, and this obviously as well connects to the character of Picard, which is the idea that there's this destiny, this idea that the things that happen to us aren't accidents, because whether they are good or bad, with perspective and time, you can see them in a new light, and they can be seen as maybe good, or at least necessary to put us on the right path to be in the right place at the right time. That kind of idea of like, and one of my favorite bands, they have a song, and one of the lines is, you have to walk the rocks to see the mountain view. And this, and what's really fascinating is this season has a lot of spiritual implications mm-hmm. to it. And this is a huge one, which is this idea that, yes, bad things do happen, but it's amazing that with time and perspective, those bad things can actually be seen in a light to which you're like, oh, wow, I see how that makes sense that I went through this thing, because now this thing is happening and I wouldn't have been prepared for it if I hadn't. So it does give you that feeling like maybe there is some sort of larger plan at work here that is putting these pieces together.
Yeah, it's true. And I felt that as well in some of the comments that were made. And I think the conversation, we're talking here a bit about the fact that the Agent Wells had a similar experience, the monster in the dark, which was a nice parallel. But the conversation between Guinan and Q, I thought, was especially interesting in this respect about, you know, things that happened to us in the past and how we cope with them. And I want to come back to that conversation between Q and Guinan a little bit later to focus a bit more on the fact that Q is dying, and also what might be, as I said in the opening, the clue to the solution. But after they had that conversation, Guinan's talking to Picard again, and I thought it was interesting how she says about humans that when something inside you is broken, it stays with you. You live in the past until you're able to reconcile it, even if it's painful. You do the work because you want to evolve. And now my first thought when I heard that was, yeah, that's the point of the season and also might be the clue to the solution. But as what you're talking about right now, I think it also fits in very well with that idea of things happen to us in life and we do get fixated on those and we do have difficulty overcoming them at times, but we keep at it and we keep trying and we keep pushing forward because we want to move past that. And eventually, usually we're able to reconcile it and then take that next step forward.
No, I think you're absolutely right because, and I mean, it's the eternal question, right, for humanity, which is why do bad things happen to good people? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, to that, I always ask, why do good things happen at all? You know, I think that's a better question. But in that, I think what is amazing is that for the most part, I think in human life, and I think that Deep Space Nine and this show here with season two and Picard is doing a really fantastic job of showing us the way in which the experiences that we have, they go into forming us and making us who they are. And although there are many experiences to which we do wish we had never gone through, they make us the people who we are to be able to face a moment later on in our path where we take a different approach. We have a different choice to make because we have learned from the past. And you know, I think one of the things that's so beautiful, Chris, and we talk about it on so many of the different podcasts that we do here. I mean, we're constantly talking about this idea with the movies we talk about in the 602 Club, which is this idea of how important history then is. Our personal histories to teaching us and molding us and shaping us, but also the history of the world. Right. And being able to learn and to grow from the experience of other people so that I don't necessarily have to experience the pain and suffering of some others because I'm able to internalize their lesson without actually having to experience mm-hmm. it for myself. And so how both of these things, I think, make so much sense as to why they help shape us. And that is something I loved about the episode is that it really was doing a good job of showing us that if we're able to pull out to a 30,000 foot view, which is what Picard has, right? He has a 30,000 foot view on all of this stuff going on, you know, for these people's lives in this century and what it can be.
Right.
But he needed to be able to do that for his own life, right? He had to have somebody pull him out to that view and to be able to see the forest for the trees, right? And that's exactly what he's able here to do with his conversation with Wells, which I think is great. What we're seeing here throughout this season, and we've talked about it multiple times, is that this whole season is about making people more whole by reconciling what happened in the past and being able to then, as Guinan says, to evolve into better versions of ourselves because of the work we do. What I appreciate about this is that the work is hard, mm-hmm. that they are not saying that this is going to be easy. Life sucks a lot of the times. It is hard and it is difficult, but it is those joyous moments that help us realize that it was worth it to go through those things so we could get to the other side, so we could get to the mountain view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Which I kind of feel that comment plays into the Rios storyline a little bit for me, for both sides, for Rios himself and for Teresa both.
Great. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I didn't think about that. Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's, oh my gosh, Chris, that's such a great point because I think that might be the best connection I've heard so far then about the Rios story because he's falling so hard for Teresa and yet all of that he went through before we saw season one of Picard with season one of Picard, and now to where he is, where we saw him at the beginning of this season, of being somebody who feels more whole and healthy emotionally. He went through a lot of hard work to get there.
Yeah.
And it was painful and frustrating, and yet he did it, and he's on that other side, and I think he's finally starting to realize there are things that I could do to make myself an even better person, a more joyful, happy person. And some of those choices would be falling in love, having a family, those kind of things. And that's that. I mean, wow, that's a great point.
I think the same is true for Teresa. The things that she has gone through are different, of course, but she also has had struggles. She's constantly working, as she talks about. She works with people who are in a difficult situation in their own lives and in the world that they're living in. And she's also finding this connection and this bridge to Rios. So that part of the story for me feels... We have a bunch of different stories going on, and how do they all connect together? And the Rios part of the story seems to be the part that we're seeing the least of. And then how does it fit into the overall narrative, the overall mission, the overall outcome, even of what we're seeing? And just listening to you talk about that really made me think about how Rios fits into the, not necessarily the let's save the world part of the story, but the internal part of the story, which is really the core of season two.
Yeah, I think that's really great, because to get to a dying Q, this idea that he's dying and or evolving into something else, we're not quite sure exactly which one it is, but it seems to be leaning more toward the fact that he's maybe dying. But he wants to believe that, you know, he is on the threshold of the unknowable. And what he longs for is the warm glow of meaning. What I was fascinated by this is that even for a quote-unquote omnipotent being of Q, he feels purposeless and meaningless, especially in his long-lived existence. He doesn't seem to... And I think that's one of the reasons that he has spent so much time meddling with Picard, and because Picard was so full of purpose. And that even a godlike being like Q isn't big enough to give himself enough meaning. And if Q's not big enough to give himself meaning, what does that mean for us as humans? Which is was a fascinating question to me. And then he asks this question, which is, can a single act redeem a lifetime? And it made me wonder, with the idea of that something broken inside of you that you work to reconcile, and then you can work to evolve, how do you then escape being stuck? Q feels stuck, and that's why he says it's the escape that matters. And for him too, it's like, okay, if I'm dying, well, Q's been a real poop head his entire existence, right? Like, that's just me being PG.
I think Ricardo told you to say that, right?
Exactly. So how do you redeem a lifetime? Is it possible to be given redemption, to earn redemption for all that he's done? And I mean, all of these questions are just so philosophically dripping with, you know, incredible meaning, because they're all the questions that we deal with as humanity. But I also believe they're such spiritual questions, and there is no real, true, I think, easy answer for people to come to with these things.
Well, if we wonder why is Q doing this, which we've been wondering since the first episode, why is Q doing this? So now if we know that Q is dying, and given what he said in this episode, which you just talked about, maybe he feels, because he knows Jean-Luc, so he knows that Jean-Luc is stuck. We have to assume that Q knows some of these things about Jean-Luc and maybe his past and how he feels stuck in a sense emotionally because of his past. And we just don't know that because we didn't see that in the episodes that we were given with the two of them together. But let's just assume that they know each other a bit better than we're aware of. If Q is dying, if he's looking for an act that he feels maybe can redeem his life as he disappears into nothingness, as he says, perhaps he feels that helping Jean-Luc become unstuck will be that act that redeems him, Q, as his life ends. And therefore, that's the reason that this whole thing started. Now, what I did find interesting, though, is Guinan asked, why did you bring him to the past? And he said, I didn't do that. He did that on his own. I thought that was kind of interesting because it suggests that this whole thing wasn't set up as some grand puzzle by Q, but rather it was set up in a way where maybe Picard internally would determine the form that it took. And because he's stuck in the past because of his family history, what ended up happening is that he ended up in the past, had to go to the past to deal with another family matter with an ancestor to become unstuck and to move forward with his own life.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that sense. And one of the things that is most interesting to me then is that Q has, I think, spent most of his existence in this kind of purposeless and meaningless, like, for him, he thought immortal, nothing really mattered. He didn't have to worry about the idea of what happens after death, you know, that there were no consequences to what he did. And therefore, I think he lives to the fullest extent in many ways, which I believe the end result of taking to the furthest extent the life of the secularist of the naturalist. Like, there really are no consequences. You just do whatever you want and then you die because that's all you got. For him, it wasn't even that. It's just, I don't have any consequences because I can do whatever I want. Nobody can tell me what to do. And I'm not accountable to anyone whatsoever, right? But here, the fear, and I think, again, this is such a human thing, which is to live a life of meaning, to live a life of purpose, to live a life that is, there is something that we would be accountable to, like a god at the end of time, right? Because, again, he's never had to worry about that, but now he's worried about that. He's worried about the idea that he needs to redeem himself from eons spent of making mischief. And we learn some of the terrible mischief, you know, especially like through what we see him. But I mean, we even learn that from Quinn, right? Mm-hmm. He tells us a lot of the things that Q is responsible for in the universe, which is pretty terrible. And so I'm just constantly fascinated by, again, I think the deep spiritual questions that this season is asking. And I don't know if there's going to be an easy answer for Q. And so I think you're absolutely right in the sense that Q believes that maybe his best opportunity for redemption is helping Jean-Luc Picard become an even better version of himself. Mm-hmm. One that has not only the lessons of the pain, but is one that is finally free of being stuck, which is, I mean, interesting in the sense that we've kind of seen that story play out in Deep Space Nine and how much, you know, Benjamin Sisko changed and grew because of being freed from being stuck. Yeah. The thought of Picard being free of being stuck. Yeah. Wow, that's a fantastic thought process as well, because we already know what he's done being stuck.
Right.
So what is this man capable of being free of that?
Yeah. And DS9 also gives us the story of Kira becoming unstuck from her past.
Yes.
And you see how she changes by the end of the series.
It's a great point.
And,
yeah.
And also, just to stick with the DS9 parallel for a moment and what we're seeing here on DS9 becoming unstuck, it's very much about how others help you. Other people come into your life and help you become unstuck. And that's also what yes. Jean-Luc needed here. He couldn't do it mm-hmm. on his own.
Yeah.
Q reminds me of how we, you know, when we're young, we feel invincible, we feel immortal, we don't necessarily think much about whether what we're doing mm-hmm. is worthwhile, or what are the consequences of it, just kind of how fun.
Yes.
That's the cue that we've seen in the past. But as we get older, we become more aware of our own mortality and we start to think more about the outcomes of things, decisions. Sometimes we look back into the past. Maybe we have regrets. Maybe we become stuck. We also start thinking about what do we leave behind in the world, right? And that's what I think Q is starting to think of here. So I'm glad that they've used the passage of time since the Next Generation to show us these characters at this stage of their life. They've let the characters age with the years that have mm-hmm. passed. And it's a nice parallel for me with what they did with the original series cast. If you think about Kirk in the original series, mm-hmm. and then you think about Kirk in the films, and how the original series movies are so much about all the characters, but Kirk in particular, coming to terms with age. Mm-hmm. And yeah. a change in how he sees the world. And I think we're seeing a very similar thing here with Jean-Luc, but in particular with Q.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point because I think you think Kirk in Star Trek VI, and it's like the culmination for him of mm-hmm. everything that he's learned and finally, again, letting go of some things that he's held on to for quite a long time. And that, of course, have been exasperated by the experiences he's had as well. And I think that's one of the things that here, the show is not saying is not important. Because I think, you know, with freeing Corey and that whole thought process there, I was really struck by with her that quote unquote father tells her that reality is a construct of the simple minded fools who can't function in the absence of boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found fascinating about that is that that's absolutely not true. We as human beings function in reality because reality is what it is, and we either deal with it or we don't deal with it. And so the idea then, and that is why a lie can be so damaging, right? Why is Corey so broken in this moment? She's found out she's been lied to, that nothing she thought was real is real. And so things being real matters. The relationships you have, the love that you have with each other, the idea that that our relationships help form us and make us, they help make our reality what it is, right? And that's why we feel so betrayed when something turns out to not be real. So I really loved this whole idea with her because, again, I think it's connecting with all the other stories, but it's also unique for her in this moment. And it is saying something that kind of connects with what Elnor told Rafi, which is there is honor and truth, and the truth of reality matters. It's not like just your truth or my truth, but the truth is, and Corey realizes this, her father, for all intents and purposes, the person who created her, does not love her. He right. loves her as one thing, this kind of possessive, kind of almost like Anakin Skywalker type of thing, right? But that's not real love. And so that absolute truth of him not really loving her in the way that she thought she did is a reality that shatters her world. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, that's... That, talk about being really philosophical. And like, that's kind of like the next generation at its best, right? That's what it was, is always doing. And this really struck me hard.
And talking about letting go of the past and becoming unstuck. One way in which Adam Tsung has been stuck is that he's been determined to succeed with these experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
he decided Corey would be the last, but he says he would do anything mm-hmm. to make sure that it's a success. And then Q gives Corey her freedom and she leaves, which frees Tsung to help the Borg Queen with whatever mm-hmm. her plan is, which we should talk about a little bit as well. But it's just another facet, another angle of the same theme that's running through the whole season, which is about becoming mm-hmm. unstuck.
Chris, I did have to ask you before we leave the section here on Tsung that we're talking about, which is we learn, and this is one of the connecting points of the episode we were talking about earlier, of how this episode is really connecting all of these disparate pieces that have been going on, and they're finally, mm-hmm. you know, coming together to make sense, which is fantastic, and I love it. What did you think of the revelation of what Agnes, as the queen, tells him would be possible if he helps her?
Well, I think, as you would expect from the Borg Queen, she's playing exactly on
mm-hmm.
his greatest desires and also his fears. It's the same way that she connected with Jurati from the beginning, right? She knows how Jurati feels inside. She knows what Jurati wants. And here we see the same thing with Tsung. You know, he wants to be that person who transforms the world, the person who has power, of course. And we talked a couple of shows back, maybe it was last show, about how no matter, like, we're at a fork in the road, and whichever way we go, Adam Tsung influences humanity's future in some way, either mm-hmm. leading to the tyrannical future that we saw at the beginning of this season, or to the eugenics wars. And, you know, we've acknowledged that maybe the timelines don't line up here right now in terms mm-hmm. of what we know from past Star Trek, but we do know that Adam Tsung is responsible for eugenics studies, which could be connected. But even if he's not, his research plays into what happened at the beginning of season one with the attack on Mars, with those artificial mm-hmm. life forms and such. So he's very influential to the future one way or the other. But she plays on that desire by raising fear in him that might not happen, right? Because if Renee goes to mm-hmm. Io, finds this life form, brings it back, and it renders his research obsolete or brings into question what he's doing, they don't mm-hmm. need him in the future, then maybe,
right,
maybe that path will close off for him. And
mm-hmm.
he's clearly, he's someone who clearly thinks that he's far more intelligent than everyone else. And he's also clearly an unstable person. There's even that scene when he beats Q for the first time in the restaurant. And he says, well, if you really know so much about me, you know that I'll kill you right now if I think you're a threat. Right. So he's that person who doesn't have boundaries, like we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was wondering how the Tsung storyline was going to connect with everything else that was going on. And I will say that when I watched this the first time and you hear the footsteps, I thought that was going to be Q coming in to see Tsung. But instead it was Queen Agnes.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that's really interesting about this section is that I've seen a lot of people kind of complaining about why would one, she go to him in the first place, or, you know, why would Earth turn to him? And, you know, whatever the ecological disaster that she said is going to happen, it's going to have people turning to, you know, scientists. And my guess is, in all honesty, is that the reason is because his research could help save humanity because of the genetic experiments he had been doing. And so that, to me, that made complete sense. And then the reason why Rene coming back with a life form that is deemed to possibly be sentient, why wouldn't they then turn to Soong in their moment of need? And possibly that is because whatever she brings back helps them to overcome that problem, right? Or realize that they don't need to radically alter humanity forever without trying to find an answer outside of, you know, the confines of Earth. So I think there's a couple of different ways that that could happen. All in all, I don't know if we can say that the Borg Queen is the most reliable narrator. I think she's saying exactly what she needs to say to get Soong to help her so she can get what she wants. And therefore, I'm sure that in all honesty, she's probably fudging a lot of this anyway. Yeah. And so to me, that's the thing that I come away with, is that she's doing what she needs to do to get what she needs. It has nothing to do with Soong. She's just telling him a story because she knows that's what's going to make him help her. And the reason I get this is because remember what Seven said earlier in the episode, which is that it's so easy to read people when they trust you. His face was a map. I knew exactly what to say to him. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what Jurati, as the queen, is doing here.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely this is for her own selfish purposes. Now, what those purposes are still isn't entirely clear, but there's something that Seven said in this episode that made me start thinking where that might be going. Well, there are a couple of things, actually. One is that Seven said that if she were the queen, she would want nothing more than closeness and to be connected again, right? Mm-hmm. And in First Contact, we saw the Borg come back in time to try to destroy humanity in the past and assimilate Earth as a way of neutralizing a threat to their own existence in the 24th century and to stop the Federation from forming in the first place. But here, I don't get the feeling that the Borg Queen wants to assimilate Earth. I think it's a selfish motive that she just feels disconnected and she wants to feel connected again. She's on Earth, so these are the people who she will try to assimilate. But there's this part in her still, like when she doesn't kill Raffi, and Seven said mercy is not a Borg characteristic.
Yes.
And so back to my whole thing I've been talking about all season about how maybe the Borg Queen who comes through the rift is Jurati and the voices are humanity from the past, but they're acting differently than we would expect the Borg to act. And in this episode, I'm starting to think that that's because the Borg that are going to be created here, and we see it at the end of the episode where she does start to assimilate a group of humans, that they inherit characteristics of Jurati. So they are a different kind of Borg than we're familiar with.
Yep.
And also Seven made the comment here that with imperfect metals comes imperfect assimilation. So that also plays into the idea that this Borg Queen is going to create a new collective, but it's an imperfect collective. It's not what we've known in Star Trek in the past. And that's why they come to the future asking Picard for help, saying they want to join the Federation. And that's where I still think that that's where it's headed, as I've been talking about. But what hasn't been clear is what is the Borg Queen herself, not the combined Borg Queen, but just the Borg Queen. What was going to be her role? What is her motive in the storyline? And I think Seven's comment here about just needing to be connected, and the fact that the overall storyline of the season for all the characters is so internal to them, who they are as individuals, that we're seeing that individual need in the Borg Queen, whereas we don't normally think of Borg as being individuals.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and something that you know, you had also brought up before we started recording, which I think was fantastic, was the idea that the Ross Arena kind of feels like a little bit of the Borg ship, especially the one we see in the opening credits. Yeah, yeah. And so that possibly that's a Borgified version of that. And I think, again, that's obviously a part of the story that's going to be working into the greater themes here, which is the getting unstuck, and would we possibly say that the Borg have been stuck, you know, with this search for perfection, and maybe realizing that that perfection and the way that they're searching for it isn't possible, but they could find something just as good or different that could actually bring them more meaning and more purpose, but would lead them less homicidal maniacs towards other, you know, species, mm-hmm. to add biological and technological distinctiveness to their own, know? Yeah. And so I think all of that makes for a really interesting discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the ship. It really stood out to me in this episode because we have that scene where we're kind of zooming in to the La Serena as we start the Rios scene. And something about the way that the camera approached the ship this time really stood out to me more, how the Borg ship, and we see it in the opening credits unfurling, how similar it looks to the La Serena. And again, it ties into my idea that that's the ship that comes through the rift in the beginning. Another interesting thing about the Borg Queen here and the comment about Mercy not being a Borg characteristic, but yet we're seeing Mercy now in this Borg Queen who is evolving, and thinking about, have the Borg, as we've known them, been stuck? And my first thought on that was that the Borg as a species are kind of stuck because they just roam from place to place, assimilating things, but they don't change very much. At this point in the 24th century, 5th century, they're so technologically advanced that, yes, they might assimilate some new technology and get some new abilities, but overall, they feel like they've stagnated when I look at them.
That's a good point.
But if you think about the fact that they assimilate the people of a world, not just the technology. And so here we see the Borg Queen taking over Jurati, but inheriting Mercy from her. And there's also, you know, Q mentions that one thing that he hates about Elorians is empathy.
Yes.
Another thing that Guinan mentions in here, and she's mentioned many times, is that she's sort of in tune with the space-time continuum, and she mm-hmm. can feel changes yes. and flux in the space-time continuum, which is the same ability that the Borg Queen has. So we know that the Elorian homeworld was assimilated by the Borg. We've known that since the Next Generation. So maybe the Borg, they assimilate these characteristics. So maybe they gained that ability to feel changes. And the Borg Queen even shows the ability to have empathy because that's how she connects with Jurati in the beginning anyway. And so maybe that is where there's a connection between the Elorians and the Borg. And now there will be a connection mm-hmm. between the Borg and humanity with the idea of Mercy coming in.
Well, and remember, one of, I think, the most important things was the idea that the Borg Queen was actually impressed by Jurati.
Mm-hmm.
She was impressed by her strength. She was impressed by who she was. And I think that's really going to come into play because I think Jurati has a strength to which the Borg Queen has not experienced before, which is pretty interesting. And I think, like, as we're saying, that is actually going to come into play to what happens with the Borg in the first place and could be the catalyst for change for the Borg forever. So, you know, I think all of this is really working. Again, we're bringing it all together in this episode. And one of the things we talked about, you know, I think even last week, Chris, we're like, how are we going to bring any of this together? And this episode brought all the storylines to convergence point, which is fantastic.
Yeah. They're not quite at Seinfeld level yet. in terms of bringing them all together.
Almost. Yeah.
But they're almost there. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you about one other scene that we haven't talked about much, and that's the Raffi scene with Elnor. And I get the purpose of the scene in terms of delving into Raffi's psyche and her also overcoming the past and trying not to be stuck in the past. How did you feel about the overall scene and how it was handled in the episode? Because for me, it was a little bit abrupt. It took a moment. I mean, of course, because Elnor is there, you know, it's not mm-hmm. real, but was it an actual flashback or was it something in her that she was just thinking about the moment? Which I guess it was both. But anyway, how did you feel like the transition yeah. within the story, you know?
I really thought that this worked pretty well for me. And what I was thankful in it was the fact that we actually finally saw why this was so important, you know, how this fit with the rest of the story. And this is Raffi's change point, right? Which is she's somebody who manipulates people to get what she wants out of them. I think it's probably one of the things that obviously ruined her marriage, and it ruined her relationship with her child. And now we see it ruining relationships with not only Seven, but also with the repercussions of what happened with Elnor, where she feels completely responsible for his death because she's the one who manipulated him into going into Starfleet. And so I think it works pretty well for me. The writing may be a little bit on the nose. She might be a little bit too obvious in that and what she's doing. But, you know, it also makes sense that Elnor wouldn't necessarily pick up on all of that because he's not quite used to the way we humans mm-hmm. work. And so, yeah.
If I think back to the moment when they transition to the scene and what's going on just before that, yeah, I think it makes a bit more sense for me. It just felt a little bit abrupt, I suppose. But no, I think I understand. And yeah, you have mm-hmm. a really good point about that. And at least now we know what happened. So it's a lot of...
Yes,
we're getting absolutely. A little bit of they're filling us in on the history of mm-hmm. part of the story that we hadn't seen yet or before the season started, actually. All right, good.
Yes.
Well, what are your final thoughts on this episode and what's your rating?
Oh my gosh. Well, I feel like this was such a full episode. I feel like we had so many things to talk about. And I think one of the things that is continuing to impress me about the series is the fact that we are asking such big questions in a way in which I think for the most part has not been preachy, which is phenomenal. I saw a quote actually from our brand new Captain Pike, Anson Mount, and I was actually very encouraged to hear them say this, which is the idea is that, you know, with the political nature you can have of Star Trek, he said, the idea of these things is to just raise good questions, not necessarily to preach at people and give them the answers. And I think that's what this season, for the most part, is doing. And I think that's what fits so well within the best of Star Trek structure, right? And this is what Star Trek has always done well when it's doing itself well, right? Yeah. If that makes any sense. Yeah. So I really liked this episode. I could quibble, you know, here and there about the fact that I still don't understand how this all fits with the rest of Star Trek history, but at least it doesn't leave me feeling the way Star Trek Discovery did. And I think because the storytelling for the characters is so good, it's that stuff which then is ameliorated because the actual character work is so fascinating. So, man, I think I would give this maybe 4.5 out of 5 half-eaten batteries.
Oh, wow.
Because Yeah, it's just, I think it's really good. I think it's very, very good.
I just had this vision of, you know how Apple has built those robots to disassemble iPhones and recycle the metals and all from there. I just had this vision of Queen Agnes. Her job is just to eat batteries to recycle, to dispose of them safely.
And can we talk about how great that scene was with Jeri Ryan, where she's talking about, you know, her own assimilation and how she can even taste the metals in her mouth, you know, how terrible and terrifying that would be. So all of that stuff was just fantastic as well.
Yeah, definitely. But back to what you were saying, I think the key here is that this is plot in support of characters, whereas what we've 100%. Been getting on Discovery is characters in support of plot.
Nailed it.
And that's the biggest difference. So you might watch the story and feel like this doesn't quite fit in with Star Trek in the way I want it to, or this story, I don't know why this one is here, or you might feel this moment is meandering. But in the end, it's all supporting the character exploration, which is why I feel ultimately it's working so well. And I'm glad to see that going on. I hope that's what we get in Strange New Worlds, because you just mentioned Anson Mount's comments about themes in episodes. And it's why you and I love Deep Space Nine, because that is as grandiose as the plot in that series is, it's still all in support of characters. It's a backdrop to the characters. Yes. And that's what this story is this season, which is wonderful. Last thing, one question for you. Do you think they should have done like a X-Files crossover in this episode and maybe even got a spinoff going somehow? They do that in the comics.
Or if David Duchovny had been the man that walked in the room. Maybe. Yeah.
They do that in comics, you know, where they mash up two franchises.
Yes.
So.
Yes. You know, that would have been kind of funny, actually.
Yeah.
Probably would have taken away from the episode. Yes. I mean, because he was already in, I think, the episode of what was it, Relativity and Voyager. He's in. Yeah. And so that's one of the things I've seen people like wishing that there had been a connection to Star Trek Voyager in that way, because he's already in a time travel episode. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, I think sometimes, you know, you don't need those connections. Especially if they're not really going to serve the story.
Exactly. Yeah. So. It wouldn't serve the story, but it was set up so well. It was like such a, you got that feeling, right? Like you're in the X-Files for just a moment.
And
the other thing we didn't mention, which we should mention, is just the fact that how many times did the Vulcans come to Earth before first contact? I thought the Carbon Creek callback was nice. And it actually fits in on the timeline, because I'm just guessing how old this agent is, but he's probably like late 40s, early 50s. So that moment when he's a kid was probably like around 80. Could have been the end of the 70s, could have been the early 80s. And it's around the right time as a follow-up to Carbon Creek for when the next survey mission would have happened, which they mentioned in the episode. And there's a chance for Mestral, for example, to come back and visit Earth again. So it was a nice little connection that if you know the story of Carbon Creek, you're like, oh, yeah.
Yes.
And if you don't, it still works, because at least you know who Vulcans are. And he had an encounter with them sometime in the past. So that was nice. So anyway, I'm going to give this episode 7 pieces of cake, all a different type.
Fantastic.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Mercy and on how season 2 of Picard is unfolding so far. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's our closed listeners group. If you're not yet a member, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right on up. If not, just type the whole name. It is a closed group, so please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. We'll put a post there for this episode, and you can share your comments with us and fellow listeners and extend the conversation beyond the podcast here. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact, choose to send to a show, and choose the artificial tango, and that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username is trekfm. That's our name on Twitter, Instagram, and everywhere, and we'd love to hear from you there. And lastly, if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Help other people find the show and find the network and join in the discussion about Star Trek Picard. So, Matthew, when you're not, you know, searching for the top primo gourmet batteries for your next meal, where can people find you?
Oh my gosh, that's a never-ending search. But when I'm not doing that, you can find me on social media under the name Matt Rushing 02. So Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, Vero, any of those type of places. I'd love to catch up with you. You also find me here on the network. I am doing the 602 Club, which is our whole other side of the network not devoted to Star Trek. And we love talking about that. I even mentioned it here on the show. We have a blast. So I hope you will check that out. And then, of course, doing Warp 5, The Orb, Literary Treks, and Saddle Up! So, Warp 5 is about Star Trek Enterprise. The Orb is about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Literary Treks is about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And Chris, Saddle Up! We have just dove into strange new worlds. And we released the first episode as we talked about the character of Christopher Pike. And gosh, we are, I would say, chomping at the bit to get that show on the air. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network doing two shows. One is called Owlpost with Drea Kaufman. That's a completed show where we talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then John Mills and I are talking Star Wars on aggressive negotiations. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out, you know, which foot gets you into the saddle so you can get around to the other side of the saddle, where can people find you?
We're really into the horses these days, aren't we, Matthew, with Saddle Up?
Yeah.
Kicked off. So,
you know, just trying to tack it on.
Do that in the tack room, right? So anyway, yeah, you can find me, as you mentioned.
Don't bridle my enthusiasm, Chris.
You can find me, as you mentioned, on all those shows that you and I do together, talking Enterprise and DS9 and Strange New Worlds. And then Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. I have Interphase, which is a Star Trek Universe podcast, and various other things going on, also working behind the scenes. And if you want to chat with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on social media. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That is my username everywhere in social media, and I'd love to talk with you about Star Trek or Japan or anything else. Horses. I actually had horses when I was growing up for a while, so I can remember a few things there. And of course, we can talk about Strange New Worlds, so hit me up there on Twitter if you would like to chat. And if you'd like to help us keep everything here on the network going, we could definitely use your support through Patreon. If you'd like to find out how to get involved in the network and help us keep everything going, just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to find out how. And you can be an associate producer. You can join in discussions on the roundtable and such. And we would love to have your support. And we really thank everyone who is supporting us right now, and especially our associate producer of this show, The Artificial Tango, Cornelia Rotner. Cornelia, thank you so much for your support. We would not be here without you. And thank you to everyone who is supporting us. Well, Matthew, we only have two episodes left to see how all of this plays out, and I just can't wait.
Awesome. Well, Chris, I am so excited to get to the last two episodes, so make it so.
Well, I'm just here to watch Agent Wells because he just has one question for you, Matthew. Are you ready to tat up? Maybe we should explain that.
I've decided that tattoos are not for me, but I appreciate the offer.
All right. That will not make any sense to anyone. The artificial tango tat.
You know, sometimes Chris and I just have pre-show conversations and they just flow right into the show.
All right.